Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Kevin Bien. He is a dog trainer and author. His new book is called Your Dog is Your Mirror, The Emotional Capacity of Our Dogs and Ourselves. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me, Mary.
So you are a dog trainer. Your father was a dog trainer. You learned all about ideas like pack hierarchies, alpha dogs, punishment and reward. But you learned over time that those things don't get to the heart of really understanding our animals. Tell us about your journey that led you to a deeper understanding of dogs.
Right. I began in the business with my dad, as you mentioned, and he was possibly the first family dog trainer and also one of the first to apply the concept of a pack hierarchy to explain the dynamic between a dog and their owner. And so I started apprenticing under him. I grew up in the business, and I'm working alongside him. And at first, I didn't have any questions. But the more I looked at what was going on, the more I started to have questions, such as little dogs always, quote-unquote, dominate big dogs, female dogs always dominate male dogs, and cats always dominate dogs. So this whole idea of a dominant hierarchy didn't make sense. And sometimes you see a dog will get a bone. It could be the so-called omega, the runt of the litter, and the alpha comes over to take it, and the little runt will growl and bare his teeth, and the alpha leaves him alone. So if something like that happened in the military where the general wants to look inside the private's footlocker, I mean, he's got to open the footlocker. There's no such thing as that. So the little dog didn't get corrected. There's no issue of rank or insubordination. And then I got into the active working dog sports, such as Schutzhund or police dog training. And it became clear from working with Germans that the prey drive was really what organized social life in canines. So the bigger the prey that an animal has to hunt, the more social they are. So I started to see that people were misidentifying that this, how wolves live as a pack was how they worked as a team. And it's actually the other way around. How they work as a team determine how they live as a pack. And that made total sense because my dad was a master at bird hunting. And his dogs were known. He was renowned to have a dog working very close under the gun. And the way we trained those dogs, it wasn't through dominance. It wasn't through obedience training. We knew where the prey was. So we would hide the bird where we knew where it was, and we'd bring the dog into the wind and help him find it. But we could set him up and have a nice set, a nice point with his tail. And we taught him that if he listens to us, he gets that soft, warm body in his jaws. So we could work with him anywhere. And that's where I ended up with my family dog people, is teaching them that if their dog was aligned around this desire, they had a wonderful working relationship. It wasn't based on dominance. So that led me to part company with a dominance thing. Meanwhile, I was studying the science on dogs, and that didn't make sense at the same time until I got to that idea that the prey organizes the predator, not the other way around.
As you write in the book, when you think about wolves in nature before they're domesticated or non-domesticated wolves, their prey is really, really big, a lot bigger than they are. And it's really awesome when you think about, awe-inspiring when you think about dog behavior, that this is what they're descended from. How do wolves survive in hunting such huge prey?
Yeah, that's a seminal question, and it's not by overpowering their prey, it's by confusing their prey. So if you look at lions and other great predators and even African wild hunting dogs down in Africa, they hunt by the prey tries to confuse them. The prey runs in every direction, and hopefully the predator loses its bearings. But in the northern hemisphere, the wolves hunt, they can't overpower the defense of the herd. So they have to feel which one in the herd is getting scared or confused, and that's the one they all align around. So if one of the wolves feels that one of the prey is weakening, then they all align around that wolf, and they press the advantage. And if they can get a break in the formation, that'll expose the young. And if they can confuse the mother and separate it from its calf, they have a chance. They have a kill. So they're hunting by feel. Unlike any other predator, wolves are hunting by feel. My proposition is that's what man exploited, and he didn't tame it. He actually amplified it, which is why every breed of dog invariably has something to do with hunting. And this desire to hunt, to have a physical appetite that's beyond the physical means of its consummation, that's why bird dogs will hunt birds all day. They may not go after a moose, but they'll hunt the bird all day long. Whereas you notice with our cats, they go out, and if they were to get a bird, that's it for the day. They come in the house, have a nice long snooze on the couch. But the dog works all day long because of this innate desire. It's an overwhelming appetite for emotional contact. I believe that's what pulled them to the heart side of early man, and man inadvertently amplified it by his mutual interest in the same kind of thing, hunting a prey that was physically superior to him.
So you have the situation where, as you described, in a pack of wolves, they will figure out, maybe one of them or somebody will figure out which is the most vulnerable prey among the large animals that they're stalking. And then they get a kind of, what would you call it, groupthink, where they all immediately come together to do their hunting. It's not an individual, it's a kind of groupthink.
Exactly, and the words that we need to describe it, we have to even get out of the whole mental rational idea. It's about alignment, and I love the word syncing. They sync up. So what's happening, and you can see the signature of this when dogs play, what they're actually doing, they're not playing for fun, although they're having the greatest amount of pleasure they could have, but they're actually playing to sync up. And it's that state of synchronization. They're actually playing just as if two kids are on a seesaw, one going up, one going down. And if we look at what they're doing, one's assuming prey polarity, one's assuming predator polarity, and then they flip those roles. Just like kids when they play the exchange roles of good guy and bad guy, where they're flipping those roles, and that actually makes them feel energized. And they get so energized that now even playing won't satisfy it. They got to work together toward overcome a common objective. So this syncing up gets them so energized that they want to work together to satisfy that heightened state of energy. So that would be like a team, a bunch of people get together and they start singing informally and they get really good at it. Well, then they want to start entering contests. They want to start doing singing competitions. So they've gotten really synced up. They're making this beautiful harmony. And now they want to go out there and overcome more resistance and challenges and keep amplifying that good feeling. So that's what's going on with dogs when they're playing. They're building themselves up to this peak state, and that would then be a prelude to the hunt. So if we look at wolves, they get all playful right before they hunt. And a lot of people have problem dogs or dogs that run away. They'll notice that their dog will start playing with them, and they'll get to a spawn point, and then they'll take off. And the reason is because they're not in tune with that whole hunting thing. And the dog has to go off and look for his own. But from his point of view, why aren't they going with him?
Right, right. Now, dogs are domesticated. They are genetically very similar to wolves. How are they still, well, they're still like wolves in the way that you say. How are they different from wolves?
Well, I believe they are the group part of the wolf with very little of the pack. So they're the teamwork amplified, but the instinctual part is minimized. And that's why I use the term emotional capacity. So every animal, organism, individual has a certain emotional capacity. And by that I mean that they can go by feel. And when you go above that capacity, then instincts take over. So there are certain conditions where any animal can communicate with any other animal. It's even an amazing example of a tortoise and a 100-year-old tortoise and a young hippo that was swept away during the 2004 tsunami. They brought them together in a game refuge in Kenya, and it's really cool to look it up online, and they're hanging out together, and the hippo mews and the tortoise comes, and it's completely non-reptilian behavior. But they're in the same common operating system. So every animal has this, but when they exceed their capacity, their instincts take over. And what's unique about the dog was that domestication didn't dampen this wild capacity, it amplified it. So in man's world, we have so much hectic change and so much stress and so much different scenarios are taking place, but the dog can still feel what his owner is feeling in the midst of all this chaos, whereas a wolf has much more instinct, and he can't. He will eventually revert to instinct, and that's the end of his ability to adapt to change.
You start off the book quoting Michael Pollan about how many more domesticated dogs there are than wolves in this country right now, and basically the question he raises, and I'd never thought about considering it this way, is what do domesticated dogs know that wolves don't know?
Yeah, he posed that so well, and that's exactly what they know. They know what we feel. I remember I quote it in the book, or I reference it in the book, and I think it was 2003, the New York Times ran a piece on apes and what they have in common with human nervous development, and it's a big cover story on that. In the corner of the page, it was the New York Times, was a photo of an African village dog in the background of this photo, and the village women were crying over a sick or dying child. It may have been dead. There was no information, but the child was definitely struggling. And in the background was the village dog howling in a mournful, you know, when they just cocked their head back as if they're baying at the moon. So he was feeling what the village women were feeling, but the ape can't do that. And so what happened in domestication, as Michael Pollan was pointing out, is, and his premise is really fascinating, how these particular animals, plants and trees, apple trees and marijuana and some flowers, how they adapted themselves to fit human desire, and that's how they flourished. And that's my belief, is that's what's happened with the wolf, is that it adapted to human desire. Our desire to hunt a prey that was larger than ourselves begat our human social nature, and that's the same evolutionary track that the wolf was on. And so by intermingling our separate evolutionary destinies, we evolved into total human beings, whereas the dog evolved out of the wolf and into the dog. And Jeffrey Mason has a new book out, and I take issue with just about everybody out there, but one thing he's saying is so compelling is how he's offering the proposition from his interpretation of the archaeological evidence that the domestication of the dog might have been the seminal event that made humans human. So that would really be neat. I would like to see that. I have very few romantic notions when it comes to dogs, but I think that would really be quite the story if that turns out to be true.
We're talking to Kevin Behan about his book, Your Dog is Your Mirror, The Emotional Capacity of Our Dogs and Ourselves. Well, that's also, I mean, a very important thing to think about. Both we and dogs evolved to hunt prey larger than ourselves, and our social abilities and capacities are based on that evolution and that need to hunt these large prey. So really, our social groupings and feelings and stuff like that are very similar to dogs. And I guess that's not true. I mean, monkeys and chimps, do they hunt larger prey than themselves?
No, they hunt what they can kill individually. And they may hunt as a group. For example, Russell hawks will hunt as a group, but any given hawk can kill the prey. And even lions might work as a team, but any given lion is physically superior to its prey. And the one animal they're not physically superior to elephants. I mean, they don't mess with them. They'll go after a young one, but they pretty much steer clear. But the canine evolved after this prey that I asked my clients, as I mentioned in the book, I said, you should go to the Museum of Natural History in New York or anywhere, so that they have a diorama of two bull moose in full rut that are fighting. And imagine what would incite an animal to want to sink its teeth into one of those 2,000-pound steel rod pistons, and not to mention some little dogs that I've known over the years. So that's the kind of physical/emotional appetite that is in the canine temperament. And we're trying to figure out what is it about the canine, the dog, that makes them so domesticatable. And I will trace it back. I believe the strongest case, the most comprehensive answer would be they have an appetite stronger than their means, an insatiable appetite. And this is what the owner of any puppy knows. It quickly learns is how much that puppy wants to gnaw on things. Unlike a domestic cat, for example, it's very easy to satisfy a domestic cat. But a dog has an insatiable appetite. And part of my training was, my training breakthroughs was to realize, wow, we shouldn't fight that. We should channel that. So the training I was doing with my dad was mostly fighting that appetite. Like they had to learn these rules, like supposedly a pack was learning from the alpha. But that doesn't hold up to scrutiny. What's really happening is they all have this appetite, but it can't be satisfied unless they work together. And that's what it internally, intrinsically guides them into a wonderful cooperative working group. There is no leader. It's completely self-organizing. It's an emergent system. And it's kind of surprising to me that this isn't self-evident. But we get all hung up on this idea of personality, dominant personality, submissive personality. And that's where our mind kind of gets stopped at that reflection. So, just to digress or to expand on that a little further is I noticed that that was going on between dog and owner, that they were projecting something into the dog that was resonant with their own past. And they had to see it in terms of a personality because they were really trying to resolve something that a person had put into them. And that was the second half of my thesis, is that when we live with a dog, we're actually reliving how we became domesticated, and we're replaying that emotionally. And that's really at the heart of the dog-owner relationship, is the dog triggers our deepest past, which is why we feel so, when our dog does something, we feel so exposed. We feel so, we could get really angry or really ashamed. We could feel disappointed or betrayed. But if our cat does the very same thing, it goes out and mutilates a mouse, so, well, that's what cats do. You know, I'll keep Putty in. I'll put a bell on her neck so she can't sneak up to them anymore. But we don't expect them not to do it. But when we live with a dog, we expect that, and they can do that. But it triggers in us the same issues that we had to go through when we were young. And what we were really learning is, what do we do with our appetites? Because those are what got us in trouble. And that becomes our issues for the rest of our life. And what I learned with my training was, when I was working with people, I was really working with their lifetime relationship with their very emotion. And if they worked with their dog a certain way, we could increase his capacity. And meanwhile, the owner was having all these breakthroughs. Their capacity was increasing. It was really an amazing process, which inspired me to codify it and get it into an organized way so I could communicate this to others.
For me reading it, it was a little bit difficult to see, I guess maybe to see this in myself as a dog owner and dog lover. I mean, you give examples. There was one of the first examples in the book was a psychotherapist who had a Cocker Spaniel, I think, who was attacking little children. And then it turned out that this very therapist had issues with her own daughters, and that was somehow coming out in the Cocker Spaniel. And it was hard to understand, like, how would this dog know that these issues were going on and somehow act them out as if the dog were a manifestation of this woman's subconscious? It's very hard to understand that for me.
Oh, good. That's a great question. Yeah, we have inside us, deep, deep down, in our very viscera, controlled by our animal mind. And if you watch dogs, you see some amazing transferences of information, and nothing is spoken. I remember in one time I let my dog out of my house. He was up on the porch. My older dog was already in the yard, and she alerted on a squirrel that was in the yard. And she was old, and she couldn't move very fast. And my younger dog, he picked up everything just by seeing her. He had, it's just like she had a range finder, bearing, location, distance, and he just zipped right by her, never looked at her again, didn't have to, but from one instant, he picked up all that information. So that was stunning to me. And then by training police dogs, I started to hear stories from the various officers about their dog had alerted on somebody who was a criminal, and later did something criminal, or they knew him to be a criminal, but was the dog's first day on the job, and the dog wasn't doing anything illegal at the moment. So I started getting all these amazing stories. I had a few occasions with my own dog to where he picked up criminal intent in someone. And so I started to realize that they're reading something in us very, very deep. And I like to fancy myself a hard-boiled, scientific, clinically-minded person. So I really started rooting around for what could be the physical markers. And through my readings, I discovered this little brain in the gut theory of an enteric nervous system that regulates our digestion. And then there's this O-ring, system of O-rings in a network that dilates from our pupils of our eyes, valve in the heart, in our arteries. It's in every part of our body functions off of these O-rings. And it's where our sexual appetites go through, our physical appetites affect these. So I believe the dog picks up from our micro, invisible musculature, the signature of what we're actually feeling, even though on the surface we could be laughing and pretending everything's fine, but there's a part of us that could be wrenched. And what's interesting about the enteric nervous system, just like we can be digesting and not knowing, it can be having a really wrenching experience, and we're not aware of it. But I believe our dog picks that up. So in the case that you talk about, Linda, the psychotherapist, I believe when she was around children, she totally clenched up, but her personality got really going, and so she'd be exceptionally friendly and solicitous. And the dog wasn't fooled by the friendly display that she might be generating. He was completely picking up on the shutdown. So let's
and
go
you
back
know what's,
to the...
You know what's funny is probably the kids that weren't fooled by it either.
They weren't either. Right. Boy, that lady's really a little too friendly. That's true. How come she's got to pinch my cheeks, you know? That's a very good point. And then to go back to the natural evolution of this, just imagine a wolf, a troop of wolves are trotting down the forest trail, and one of them spots a prey in the bush. He just totally freezes up and locks up. And everybody, the last thing he's going to do is whine or bark because that's going to chase it away. And every other one aligns around him until they get the signal. And that's when his system would totally arrest. Now, the animal always displays what they feel. They feel what they feel. But our minds are so powerful, we may not feel what we feel, and we can, on the surface, keep on going like nothing's happening. But I don't believe our dog tunes into that surface. He tunes into the deeper part. You know, very much like a dog will pick up on an impending epileptic seizure in their owner 4 hours before any machine could ever detect anything. And sure enough, the person is warned, forewarned, they lay down, they have a seizure, they have help come over, and it's fine. They get their life back. So the dog picks up on this stuff that we're not aware of, and it's almost like a seismic detector that emanates from our core, that vibration from our core. Just to follow through with one other story I write about is once I gave myself an intention to wake up especially early, and I set my alarm clock for a little bit after that, and the subliminal intention didn't work, and the alarm clock failed to go off, but my dog came into my bedroom. He had never done that in his life. And dug my head out from under the pillow, woke me up, and then went to the back door waiting for me to let him out. It was the weirdest part was just as if I had called him by name. He looked me in the eye like, okay, what? It was the most amazing experience I ever had with a dog, and it took me a while to figure out how he did that, but that's that deep vibration that I was carrying, but I didn't even know it. Obviously, I didn't wake up, but it was in him. He could feel it, and he wasn't even in the room at the time when I had implanted that suggestion, so... They're picking up stuff that we don't feel, and that's how they know us.
We're talking to Kevin Behan about his book, Your Dog is Your Mirror, The Emotional Capacity of Our Dogs and Ourselves. Tell us the story of a dog named Neko and his fear of taxi cabs.
Right. He used to attack taxi cabs, and he went to a number of behaviorists and trainers. Nobody could figure it out because... never had a bad experience with taxi cabs. He never even saw his owner get in or out of one, and yet he would attack these taxi cabs, and he had to be on a court-ordered muzzle, and it was the little woman trying to hold him back. It was a big scene. And so she told me, especially when they have their headlights on, so right away I knew that meant it was an animal to him. It was the moose. They're masked at the canyon. She lived right in Central Park West, and all the calves would queue up at the light. And, of course, they get fidgety at the, like, the herd is about to break, and they're the first one. And then the most important thing is people pick them out. They point, and they hail them. And that means it's it. So that's the perfect definition of a hunt. And then it flops to the ground. It screeches to a halt. The legs and arms flail around as doors open and shut and takes off again. So it got to be very obsessive. But the question remained, why does it, of all the dogs in New York City, attack taxi cabs? And the woman had told me that she had been attacked in Europe. And I do business with a lot of police in Europe at the time, and they would tell me that it was a certain kind of immigrant would come in and live in the deprived areas, and they were responsible for the crime. And I'm assuming, because I didn't get a chance at the time, I was just figuring this out, I presume that it must have been the driver of the taxi cab. They're always immigrants, typically, and it must have just locked her up. And we talked earlier about our viscera clenching, and the dog must have felt that locking up when she saw a driver of a taxi cab at a light or something, and it didn't take long for the dog to pick up in conjunction with the hailing that this must be it. And that became his trigger. That was his hunt. And he was doing what his group wanted him to do, aligning around the strongest feeling that locks us up and focuses us, fixates us on what their energy is supposed to do. And along those lines, it's interesting that the number one chewed household item today is no longer the slipper, the fluffy little thing. It's now the remote control TV clicker.
Right,
that's what
right.
We're all focused on. So that becomes the puppy's prey. So this hunting mandate template is how they know how to adapt to us, and it's why it works and why it doesn't work, and then why they do some of the funny things they do.
So how did you deal with the dog and the owner around the issue of taxi cabs?
Yeah, I became the moose. So I taught him to want to bite a toy that I wanted him to bite, so he would see the taxi and get completely pumped up. But it became very easy to redirect him to me and give him a nice bite and play with him. And then in order to get the bite, was very easy to teach him. Since I owned the prey, it was very easy for me as Moose to teach him heel, sit, down, stay. So we would see taxi cab, and he learned to heel, sit, down, stay. And sooner or later, that worked because he got to play with me. So it became, once I became part of the flow chart, it was easy for him to align with me. But when humans weren't part of the flow chart, he fixated on the hailing part. Okay, that must be it. Then he would go into, he would breach his capacity at that point. And that's when the prey instinct takes over, and then there's no reaching a dog in instinct. And so I turned his prey instinct into prey drive, and that's all about being in harmony with the group, and more importantly, changing on the fly, changing your focus, deflecting your energies, acquiring a new focus, all to stay in harmony with the group. So that innate capacity is in every dog. We just have to make it stronger, which is what domestication did. It amplified the emotional capacity of wolves to beget the dog.
And was his owner able to then deal with the dog when she was hailing a taxi cab?
Well, that's what really led to this theory, was she started to get mad at me. The better he did, the more upset she got with me and the training. She became a doubting Thomas and started doing things that I had defined as antithetical to what we were doing. And eventually I lost contact with her. So in reflection, because I didn't follow up on that she had been attacked statement she made to me, I didn't want to go there. I was just there to train the dog. But now I realize that dog was her chance to fight back. So on a visceral level, as mortified as she was, and she was a highly civilized, intelligent woman, and that made her so upset, and she spent money to fix it. But on a deeper level, yeah, she said, "You go, dog. That's right. Get him." So, and that part she wasn't aware of, and I wasn't aware of how to help her, that was the seminal issue that she had with that dog, and that's what we should be talking about.
We're talking to Kevin Behan. He is the author of the new book, Your Dog is Your Mirror, The Emotional Capacity of Our Dogs and Ourselves. Now, you said a moment ago something which I think is profound, which is that our dogs bring us back to our own, essentially our own domestication, to reliving and somehow unconsciously or subconsciously experiencing that. Give us an example of what that looks like.
Well, I remember working with a woman who was traumatized as a young girl and had abusive boyfriends, and some very serious things happened to her, traumatic things. And then she gets a dog, and a couple of years later, sure enough, he's attacking her. So we started working together, and I started getting the dog to express a lot of deep energy, a lot of, and that all that is emotion coming out. And it was a most stunning transformation, and she was a very beautiful, mature woman. And yet, when I turned to look at her, she had regressed to a 3-year-old girl. She was crying. She was completely vulnerable and was reliving something that was obviously traumatic, which caused her to think the dog was having a hard time, but he was really learning how to express his deepest passion. And that's what gets us in trouble when we're babies. And I don't care how lovingly we're raised, God forbid when we're not raised lovingly, we pick up this, oh, my God, if I want something too much, I'll get in trouble. And then our personality develops around that judgment so we can protect ourselves from that wanting. We actually are protecting ourselves from our own force, our own power. We insulate it with our personality and then with these defensive strategies and guilt judgments. So when we get the dog, it's immutable. He will reawaken that in us. He will start to act out those personality displays. And on the one hand, we're going to say, oh, that's nice, he loves me. But then he'll do something on the other side of the equation that we're going to find very unsettling. And my work is to show people that, wow, that unsettling part, that's actually the opportunity to get in touch with your core, get right back into what you really want, and to recapture your will, and not to feed that personality part, because that's part of the judgment system. So, yeah, we relive it. And every dog has a story to tell. It's his owner's. And it never ceases to amaze me how precise they are in revealing our own past.
When I look at my own experience with dogs, I was really trying to find that. And what I see, for example, I have a dog who used to belong to somebody else. And in his old house, he would turn over the garbage cans. And from time to time, he still turns over the garbage cans. And I'm not sure how much that has to do with me. Or I had a dog who is frightened of thunder, as many dogs are. And I don't see what that has to do with me. Or
what do you do when your dog gets afraid of thunderstorms?
Well, I try to give her a bunch of blankets to hide under because that's what she likes to do, and she wants to be near me, so I let her be near me. But I don't, you know, I bought this thing called a thunder shirt, which doesn't work at all. She doesn't like to be comforted, so I just kind of am there for her and let it pass until the thunder's over. Same with fireworks.
Yeah, is there any parallel? Can you find any parallel in your own experiences when you're struggling or afraid that you may misinterpret someone trying to comfort you and be annoyed with them rather than seeing what they're trying to do?
Well, the point is, she was like that before I had her.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Plus, and one of my personal journey stories was, I used to buy dogs from Germany because I was in the police dog business, and one I kept for myself, and I bought him at 4 years of age, sight unseen, and he was the exact same as if I had raised him from a puppy. And that was kind of part of my awakening. See, that every dog I ever owned was some reflection on me. So what you want to do is look for some behavior, find that parallel in your own experience that you're just like that. And it's always there. At first, it's going to seem, I remember when I first asked myself that question, I said, nah, that applies to them. It doesn't apply to me. And then it started hitting me like a ton of bricks.
Let's say you do that. What do you do then? In other words, can you do, by my own internal psychoanalysis on thunder or scary things, can I help the dog get over the thunder fear?
Well, there's stuff that you have to do. Yes, you can heal her fear of thunder. You definitely can do it. And there's stuff you have to do, but what you're doing now is feeding it, because it's how you react to fear, how you personally react to fear. So you and her are a self-reinforcing logic loop, if you will, or system. And the solution to doing what you have to do is going to be antithetical to this personality approach that you're trying to do.
But then what do you do with that information? I mean, let's say I have an insight. Will Honey the little dog suddenly say, ah, my mommy's had an insight, I'm no longer afraid of thunder?
Yeah, I have seen it happen when people really get it, and it just rocks them, and they shift. And then the dog, and in the book, I talk about it happened with me, with my dog. I just couldn't believe it. He was very shy his whole life, although I had covered it up with training, and he looked phenomenal. But in weak moments, you'd see it, and I was very embarrassed by it. And so I released him from the judgment that caused it, as I had divined it to be. Sure enough, he changed within days. He was 9 years old, and his bark, the tenor of his bark actually dropped. It was amazing, and people wouldn't get out of the car anymore because his bark was so deep, and his whole way changed. So that can happen, but I believe that the training part, when you're learning to work with emotion, is part of art therapy as well. One of the things that has to happen with your dog is to increase her appetite for contact, real hearty physical contact, not the little petting and loving and the sweetie pie stuff. She's actually got, underneath that, fear is fierceness, and that's not coming out. And that would probably speak more to a core issue for you, that there's a fierceness that can't come out, and it can only be triggered by something really critical. I mean, why do animals hold back? Why does our animal mind hold back? Because we're waiting for a crisis. And so there's no crisis in your dog's life because she lives a great life. So the thunderstorm becomes the predator, boom, boom, booming after her. No matter where she goes, it finds her. But underneath all that panic, believe it or not, is a fierceness. And that's what's got to be expressed directly. And I teach dogs, I mean, therapeutically wise, I teach dogs to bark for food during thunderstorms. I teach them to bite, to play, to really get aggressive during a thunderstorm as the equal opposite antidote to their fear and get assertive where they would be overwhelmed.
So if you let them, for example, as I do, chase rabbits during the warmer weather and get all that stuff out of their system, because it's not happening actually during the thunderstorm, it doesn't do any good?
No, in fact, it's feeding her fear of thunderstorms because she's chasing her shadow. She'll never catch it. She's got to connect with you. In other words, what she gives to the rabbit, she should give to you, but she's not giving it to you except when the thunderstorm comes out. But she's giving it to you as panic. And what you've got to do to help her is to teach her to play with you instead of chasing rabbits. So I would suggest the next time you have a thunderstorm, you just sit and observe and try to get down to what is disturbing you about it. Like, 'cause, you know, you'll see people will have a dog like that, and the dog just does its thing. They don't care, and they go along because it's not a reflection for them. So they'll just watch it, and it's no big deal, and off they go. But it affects you in a very deep way, so you're resonating with it. So what you have to do is get below the feeling bad part, because that's not a true feeling. That's part of the rationale, and that's part of the human intellect. You got to get below that to what you're actually feeling without any thought whatsoever. For example, you may be feeling, and the typical ones, you may be feeling exposed, and shame could be attached to that. And panic could be attached to that. And that's what I'm trying to communicate to people, is to pick up on what that actually is. And once you get that feeling, second, the next thing that happens is you'll feel a release and an opening. Then the healing part is completely secondary after that. Until you get to that, what I learned with my clients is until they get to that release of the judgment, the dog is always not going to be quite right. And we've got to do a lot of maintenance training and management. But when they really get it, the dog shifts forever. And then the training is like cement.
So basically, you're asking us to go into some kind of psychotherapeutic space of our own in order to connect more deeply to our dogs, particularly in the areas where our dogs are having problems or issues.
Right. Exactly. And you know what that space is? Heart. That's our heart. And that's why everything we say of the dog, faithful, devoted, courageous, persistent, dogged, we say of heart. And that's why my proposition is that our human animal is not the ape. As amazing as his brain may be, you can even learn sign language, teach a sign language to an ape. but it's the dog. The human animal is the dog, and that's what dogs have figured out, as according to Mike. That's the answer to Michael Pollan's question. Dogs are the human heart made physically manifest, and that's why they can live with us in a way that no other animal can.
So, and as you say, they know us by heart.
Exactly. And that actually is how nature works, with the exemplar of that, the number one empathic communicator is the dog. So when we see our dog doing something, before we jump into our fix-it mode or laugh at it because it's funny. Like, if you go on America's Funniest Videos, you see some hysterical dog stuff, but it's revealing of some very profound truths, but we're laughing and we don't see the power of it. And that one incident is in my book where it became a game and everybody's laughing at the dog, but it really spoke to a very deep, unresolved emotion in the dog's owner, but it was something we laugh at. And, you know, just to focus back on your dog with the afraid of the phobia, when you were a little girl, you might have been taught that to show weakness is, or to be afraid is to show weakness. To acknowledge a fear is to be weak. And, you know, we may be ashamed when we show weakness. We have a weak moment. We may judge against ourselves instead of saying, yeah, I'm human. I'm going to have a weak moment. Sometimes I falter. And, you know, we don't necessarily accept our own limitations.
Now, would you say that every dog who's afraid of thunder has an owner with a therapeutic issue like that?
They have some unresolved fear, exactly, and it needs to come out. And it'll you know, the dog will have a few limited ways of letting a fear out, but it'll speak to, and let me put it societal, and, you know, let's look at it on a broader demographic way. The rate of separation anxiety and phobias is, in my view, from my perspective, rocketing. It's exponentially higher and higher and higher. And I believe that correlates to, as a society, we're less free to speak our mind now. You know, I love to watch the old Westerns where one cowboy said to another cowboy, or an Indian said to another Native American. They just spoke from the heart, plain and simple. And we don't do that anymore. We're very circumspect, and we have to be careful what we say. There's so many more consequences to an ill-chosen word. So we're much more guarded, and we're holding back a lot more. And so it's coming out through explosions, which is rising aggression and amazing rage in humans as well, and implosion. In dogs, we get separation anxieties and phobias, noise phobias. And in people, we have these amazing self-destructive behaviors that I think are new, such as cutting and self-medicating and suicides and a lot of dysfunction that's being mirrored in the dog population at the same time as it is in humans. So we're seeing a lot more of this noise phobic. And another way of correlating it to human behavior is, we believe that being really, really friendly is social. And that's a modern conception. Older civilizations don't have that, and older societies don't have that. So we're really concerned about being friendly. And we try to get our dogs really, really friendly. There's such a such a de rigueur that dogs have to be friendly. And people are taking their dogs out, and is he friendly? And they're supposed to all jump on each other and be friendly. And that masks a fear that's underneath it, because friendliness is really a form of defense. You're next to someone, you don't know them, so you're friendly as a way of mitigating that until you get to know them. So another way of approaching your dog's phobia is to see how much you're encouraging her to be friendly. That's not how energy moves in a dog, in the animal mind, let me put it that way.
So in these more heartfelt, older people speaking their mind civilizations, they didn't have dogs that were scared of thunder?
A lot less. I guarantee there were no Indian village dogs cowering under the teepee. I guarantee it. Look out in the wilderness. I mean, wolves are a pretty flighty. Foxes are amazingly spooky. And when the thunderstorm comes, they're not hiding. They're not running around with their head chopped off. The deer, what could be more afraid than a deer? Or, you know, and they just hunker down because they have no judgment against the fear. They have no judgment against the fear. You know, another good example of that is if you go to the city and you see a homeless person who's unfortunately demented and he happens to have a dog, that will be the calmest dog you have ever seen. He because that person is crazy, but they don't judge against being crazy. Whereas you'll see so many dogs that are hypermanic, and the people are trying to be very controlled, and everything is in its right place in their life, and everything's organized, but inside, they're going crazy. So their dog is expressing what's going on inside, because they have a judgment that, wow, if I don't have anything neat, then I must be crazy. It's sort of like OCD. They have to keep everything under tight control, or the world's going to stop spinning. So we're seeing a rise in those, and it's in the dogs because it's something that's latent in us, which really is consistent with the whole concept of how a dog became domesticated in the first place. They could feel a passion in us that they aligned with. Like, I want that deer, too. It's we have deer hounds. I want that otter. We have otter hounds. I want that puffin. We got a puffin dog, which is a double, triple-jointed dog that can touch the tip of its nose to the base of its spine, and it can climb up 45-degree cliff faces and over backwards with handholds. I mean, how do you breed a dog to do that? It's really amazing. It's just that they all wanted the same thing, and sooner or later, the genes, through just constant selective pressure for that desire, the genes conform, like Michael Pollan says, the genes conform to the force of human desire. You know, the other thing I'm saying, too, is we are a part of nature. We are not apart from nature. I believe that the evolution of civilization is part of natural civilization, of natural evolution. So,
right.
Yeah, and the dog is here to show us, yeah. I can remember in the 80s, I was really learning about the dog, about the wolf through working dogs for protection training, because it's the same as a wolf hunting to prey. And realizing that, wow, I know more about wolves through this work than the people studying the wolves. They're really just looking at the surface. I'm actually inside the wolf mind at the heart of the wolf, which is the dog. I'm actually learning how to manipulate it, and it doesn't evaporate in my fingers because I'm touching it, because it was evolved to be in compatico with us. So we don't have to go to the jungles to study nature. It's right in our, right here. And the nature that's in us is our emotion. And so, I believe that what's going on in society, we're seeing mirrored in the dog marketplace and in their health and their social constitution as well.
What does all this mean for dogs who are considered unadoptable, who are languishing in shelters? Through your methods, is there a way to rehabilitate them so they don't have to be euthanized or have horrible lives?
Yeah, I believe every dog can be rehabilitated if you find that right owner who's willing to commit to working with that. And, of course, those people are in short supply. But the real message we should be getting from this tragic situation is that what put those dogs in the shelter, it's not too many pets, it's not overpopulation, it's not hypersexual drive, it's not territoriality and this and that. The ones that we're killing have the most heart. The number one reason we kill dogs is for aggression. And those are the dogs that are willing to fight for what they want. And those are the ones we kill off. And the side effects of that are that the social constitution of dogs is getting weaker, which is why we see more panic and health and the physical constitution getting weaker, which is why we see cancer in young dogs. Now, when I grew up in the dog business, dogs never got sick. And we had no medicines in the kennel. And then in the modern dog business, as I grew up and started my own kennel, I had so many medicines and natural diets and palliatives, and I was supposed to give them all these phobic medicines and Valiums, and it was unbelievable, the medicating that had to happen. So I think we're judging against the heart of the dog, and that's really at the root of this tragedy of why we still kill 2 to 3 to 4 million dogs a year.
Kevin Behan is author of the book Your Dog is Your Mirror, The Emotional Capacity of Our Dogs and Ourselves. Thank you so much for talking with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.